You're listening to the John Tory Podcast from News Talk 1010.
So all I can say is thank goodness for competition after the last 2 days and many experiences that you've had similarly. Those who've traveled back and forth to Montreal, as I did, by air the last couple of days, will know that when there isn't competition, the service is crappy. And even when there is competition like there is now between Porter and Air Canada, the quality shoots all the way up to acceptable. Now, I know air travel by definition has become quite a hassle, and a very expensive hassle at that. My economy ticket to and from Montreal cost about $700 all in. And I know if you travel at midnight on Sunday night and, you know, travel with no bags and, you know, wear shorts, you can get a cheaper ticket. But the bottom line is that's what I had to pay to get a ticket going back and forth the last 2 days. And a lot of that, of course, is these ridiculous government and other surcharges of one kind or another. But $700 is $700. You know, you can analyze it any way you want. On top of the cost, of course, there's the security hassle. That speaks for itself, and it is the hassle as well of the actual air travel. Genius that I am, I got to the airport last night and switched myself from the 9 o'clock flight to Toronto to the 8 o'clock flight. Sounds sensible, you say, until you hear that through various claimed inspections, paperwork delays, and on it went, the 8 o'clock plane actually left at 9 o'clock. So I'd have been better off just staying on the one I was booked on. So much for that genius idea. Like many of you, I've actually taken the train before. The express-type trains, as opposed to the milk runs that stop at every city along Lake Ontario, the express trains only stop a couple of times between here and Montreal. They travel downtown to downtown. You can use your phone all the way. You can use your laptop all the way. And while they're not cheap to take, trains are cheaper than planes most of the time. And under present conditions, I would say the time spent as between trains and planes is, door to door, not that much different. Because the train's a little slower, but by the time you drive to and from the airport, you go to the airport, you go through that whole hassle there with the security and all the rest, I think the amount of time spent is about the same. Which is why I would argue, putting aside the, I think, 24 different studies that have been done, I would argue almost on that basis of simple logic alone, added to our climate, that a high-speed train line linking up Toronto, Ottawa, and Montreal would be a winner. By high speed, the present maximum speed of a VIA train is 160 kilometers per hour. There's various reasons for that, including the tracks, the equipment, the, you know, so on and so on. A high-speed train could either go at 200 kilometers per hour or 300 kilometers per hour, so that's a high-speed train. It would really speed up the journey. Which is why government after government have expressed interest in it and studied it, only to chicken out when the time comes to both put up the money and to commit themselves. And folks, it is a lot of money, $10 billion or so for the Toronto-Ottawa-Montreal high-speed train, but not all of it needs to come from the government. And I freely admit that's a lot of money, and further admit we haven't been summoned yet to even figure out how we're going to pay for the $50 billion worth of local transit that Dalton McGuinty has in his plans, let alone a high-speed train. Okay. So we all agree $10 billion for a Toronto, Ottawa, Montreal high-speed train line is a lot of money, and that we haven't figured out yet how we're going to pay for the even more urgently needed local transit, $50 billion worth of that. But you see, I think saying no, as both Dalton McGuinty and the Harper government did yesterday, no, not now, we can't afford it, that our governments are being short-sighted and making a big mistake. We have allowed our governments, plural, and by that I mean both levels and all parties, to get away with not building highways, not building transit, not building trains to the airport and high-speed trains and so on because, to quote them, we couldn't afford it. Only to then get into a crisis because of a failure to act and, in many cases, when we get around to knowing we have to act, to end up paying many times as much to actually build the subway or the road or the bridge or the train later on. It's a funny thing. They've decided in Europe, in China, in Japan, in the United States that high-speed trains are sensible, they're fast, they're environmentally better, they boost the economy, and that somehow they found a way to afford to have these things. All those countries that I would argue are in many respects poorer than us. Here, we somehow think we've got it made, that business as usual will be okay. Well, it won't. It never was going to be good enough to have business as usual if we're going to have an economy that's connected and good, efficient, environmentally sensitive transportation going forward. We're going to have to do some things that are bold. We're going to have to find innovative ways to pay for them. We're going to have to think ahead for a change and stop copping out. In my view, high-speed train service should be on that bold list. Paul Langan is the creator and founder of High Speed Rail Canada. Obviously, you know where he comes from on this, but I wanted to have him on just to see what he thought of yesterday's apparent decision for now that we can't afford it. Paul, how are you doing?
Well, pretty good, John. It's kind of a decision I've heard for 20 years now.
Why is it, just, I know you, if you had the answer to this question, you'd be a lot happier guy, but why is it that all these other countries can build, pay for, and have running these high-speed trains to great acclaim and great use by their people, and we can't?
Well, you're right. 30 to 50 years of other countries having this and us not having it has created basically a culture where when we get leaders without a lot of vision, they just can't see it because we haven't had good rail passenger service in 50 years, and trains went faster 30 years ago than they go now in Canada. So our leaders are visionless. And, you know, basically with this one, John, it boils down to the federal government not coming forward and Mr. Harper saying, this is part of the economy that's 50 years behind the rest of the world. Our transportation system on rail is 50 years behind it. And he's just not there.
So a lot of people wouldn't necessarily connect the dots between a stronger economy and jobs, which they really want, as you know. A lot of people are very worried about that going forward for themselves and their kids, and a high-speed train. Talk about the connection between the two.
Well, number one, when you put the rails in, those are real jobs that build sustainable communities. So we're not talking about these infrastructure projects they did last time around, which are just shovel-ready projects, which is, okay, you need a new roof, great. Need some more asphalt, great. But those aren't long-term, new, sustainable jobs. And again, why does the rest of the world do it for decades and decades as a standard way to move people, and we don't? And it boils down to, like I said, the leaderless vision. You know, here's my best example I can give, John, to how bad things are in Canada. 3 weeks ago, Uzbekistan announced their high-speed rail line that started up. You got it. Find that in Wikipedia.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and that's how bad it is. I think it's 80% desert. So, you know, there is no excuse as far as population, all these old excuses. I mean, United States, President Obama realized, hey, our country's 50 years behind. We got to catch up. He made the announcement. Heck, there was 3 manufacturers in the United States before he made the announcement. Now there's 120 lobbyists there from manufacturers trying to get business there. Wouldn't that be nice?
And is there Paul, because we're just running out of time, but is there private sector money? Because everybody implies this, say, the $9 to $10 billion price tag for the Toronto, Ottawa, Montreal portion, which would be a good start,
right.
Is, you know, $10 billion, we can't afford it, meaning the government's. Is there private money that would step up, given the invitation to pay for a chunk of this?
Oh, my gosh. You always need the public money to start it, to help with the infrastructure at the front. Every country in the world has done that. Okay, and then you bring in the private operator to build and maintain it, okay, and you have contracts and safeguards in there. Pretty straightforward, standard business. We're not doing it. You know, we don't ask that same question when we spend $30 billion on fighter jets. We don't ask that same question. It's all public money, and nothing comes back. You know, nothing to benefit
Canadians. That's an interesting point.
Yeah, I mean, we don't do it with the war in Afghanistan, $20 billion. How did that benefit Canadian society?
Yeah, we could have a long debate about that, or the fighter jets. But having said that, your point is that we shouldn't be making a black or white choice and saying, well, it's fighter jets and no trains, or it's Afghanistan and no trains. We should be making a long-term investment. We appreciate your coming on, Paul Langan, creator and founder of High Speed Rail Canada. Keep at this. I mean, it's only been, 25 years and 25 studies, so maybe on number 26 it'll be the lucky day.
Thanks, guys.
Appreciate your time.
Okay.
This is The Live Drive with John Tory, 416-872-1010, StarTalk 8255, or by text message at 71010. Look, I know we're out of money right now, but in the end, we keep putting off and putting off and putting off these things, and we're going to do it sometime. You know, and I just say, well, maybe we should get on with deciding on a date. We're going to do it now and figure out innovative ways to get some private money in here as well as the government money and get on with it. I just think it's longer sighted to do it that way than to get to a crisis. But you tell me. Let's hear what you've got to say about high-speed trains and our failure to embrace them and yet again take the 24th study, I think it is, and say no to not now. We can't afford it. Sean and Markham, you're on Newstalk 1010.
Yeah, I guess I'll phrase this as a question to you, John. How was it we were one of the only economies in the world to weather the financial storm that was and may even continue to still be?
Well, I mean, are you making the case by asking the question that because we didn't spend $9 billion at any point in time, even now or the future, building high-speed trains, somehow that saved us from being Greece?
I wouldn't point that to being the only thing, but I think that there's a certain financial prudency that exists within Canadian governments that while they may not be sexy or forward-thinking, and I don't even think that that is the case. I would argue that, in fact, that is forward-thinking and that is somewhat innovative. You brought up Greece. Italy might be another
example. Greece doesn't have any high-speed trains. But, Sean, let me just respond, and I thank you for the call, to your point, by saying this. I don't view high-speed trains as something you do because it's sexy or because we should say we have one because everybody else has one. I think actually, given the amount of commerce and the amount of traveling back and forth that exists, say, between those three cities, and the amount of people's time that is spent hanging around airports and so on and so forth, the economic contribution, and by the way, it's borne out by this most recent study. It did say, by the way, the investment of $9 billion would get a return, and it's not $9 billion of government money anyway. I made that point. It's the foundation of government money at the beginning, accompanied by private sector money. All of this is going to build jobs and prosperity. We didn't stay out of trouble because we didn't build high-speed trains. You know why we stayed out of trouble? Because we have less of a problem, not no problem, but less of a problem with people retiring at 50 years of age with some exorbitant pension, with jobs of people like hairdressers and massage therapists being guaranteed early retirement in mid-50s because they've had a stressful job, with people, you know, sort of signed up to work 35 hours a week and working half of that, with people not paying their taxes. That's why we're not a basket case. I mean, sure, those governments, like ours, spent too much money, but at least here people pay their taxes. At least here people do work, by and large, until they're 65. But if you think we don't have a problem with money, we do. We're not Greece and we're not, Italy, but we got problems coming down the road here, so we shouldn't be complacent. And it's not because I think part of our problem is we didn't make some of these long-term investments in things like high-speed trains.
You can listen to John Tory every weekday afternoon from 4 till 7 on NewsTalk1010.com.
Sue Ann Levy's a fighter. She gets in people's faces, often on your behalf, frankly, as taxpayers, and that has made her a few enemies over at City Hall. As is the case with most of us, there's kind of a bad Sue Ann, not really bad, but she knows better, I think, than to believe that even abolishing public art, the art that you find in parks and public places, abolishing public art, she's been writing about this for the last couple of days, and her colleagues, most of it paid for by developers anyway. She knows, Sue Ann does, that won't really save much money at all, but she has expended her clever words, I think, making out as if this is a big issue which will actually make any real difference to cleaning up the mess over at City Hall. So that's sometimes what the bad Sue Ann Levy can do, and those are the days when I sort of disagree with her. I mean, look, I think we should be very careful about how much money we spend in tough times on public art, but when it's somebody else's money and it's being done to make the city look and feel better, which I think is not of zero importance at all, that's when I disagree with her. The good Sue Ann Levy, you know, not good in terms of being goody two-shoes or anything like that, but the good Sue Ann Levy is at her best when she digs out the kinds of specifics as she did yesterday, which make the case I have been talking about for months, as has she, about the gravy train. I have said when others mocked him that Rob Ford was and is right. There is gravy at City Hall. Now, only about a spoonful of it comes from the free sandwiches or public art or even these museums that have been in the news recently. The big gravy boats, the great big vats of thick, fatty gravy, rest with an unreformed, inefficient, self-protecting, bloated, expensive bureaucracy. And by the way, lest you think, as I always say, this is some attack on public servants, all bureaucracies get this way, inside companies too, if they are allowed to. The difference, of course, comes in the fact that companies must make a profit, and that produces real accountability and the courage or the fear to make tough decisions. And they're tough. I mean, you don't think it's tough to make a decision to lay people off or eliminate people's jobs? It's the hardest thing I've ever had to do in any of my jobs, any of them. The simple fact is this. Since the city of Toronto amalgamated from all the previous cities into one, the number of employees the city has have gone up by thousands, not 53 or 46 or flat, up by thousands. And you know, anytime you're supposed to emerge, at least merge or amalgamate a group of organizations or cities or whatever, part of the idea, a big part of the justification is you can achieve economies of scale, do the same things with fewer people. So if you use the example I always find easiest to understand, it's that we had, five city halls before. Now we should only have one. Now, guess what? We still have five, and they're still full of people doing things they probably did before. That's part of the problem here. So what Sue Ann pointed out that was so interesting and informative about this, and really backs up what she and I have been saying and others, is that the weak effort they made to buy out some city employees, where they got a few people sign up because they were offered, 6 months of pay, is a shadow of what they need. They need hundreds and hundreds to retire and not be replaced, and others beyond that to be bought out. In one department, based on the sort of weak need effort they made, transportation, 137 people applied for the six-month buyout by the same management we're trying to put on a diet, by the way. That same management then took the 137 people who applied and chose, guess how many, to actually be retired? 17. So you see, they have 137 people signing up. I accept the fact, and I endorsed earlier the fact, they should be able to exercise some judgment and not just say because a guy signed up who may be anyway only a year away from retirement or he may be really good, that they have to take him. 17 out of 137 indicates one thing to me. They don't want this program to work. Because we know how management works in the private sector, but certainly in government. You're measured, and you sort of measure your own bodily appendages, frankly, talking about men here, by how many people you supervise. And so if some of your people are bought out and retire, you're not as important anymore, or you don't feel as important, or you don't feel, I don't know, you think you're having a shrinkage problem. That's what's going on here, folks. Make no mistake. And they also think that the emperor will have no clothes on anymore if some of these people retire, because they'll say, well, what do you do now anyway? Because all those people who used to work for you, we seem to make do without them. So that's what's going on here, I think. And I think we should make a more generous offer, a more broadly based offer to more of the people in the management ranks. You know that. I think it'll pay for itself in a year. And we're just not going to get anywhere with this gravy unless we go where the gravy is.
$20 million of annualized savings with the positions that have been approved. That's a big piece of our puzzle in solving the problem that you'll see come the end of November.
That was City Manager Joe Panicetti talking about the $20 million that the kind of limp buyout program achieved, but they could have achieved and should achieve a lot more than that, not just because it's about dollars, but because that's where there's a lot of inefficiency with your tax dollars. Now, Sue Ann Levy is probably best known to you as a Toronto Sun columnist, but after today, she'll be better known, even better known, as part of the very high-finishing second-place team in the selection by the Occupy Toronto people as the right-wing douchebag of the year. And the Sun group, who else was it? It was Ezra Levant and Michael Corn and you were all named there. The contest was won, I should say, by Jerry Agar and Ryan Doyle, who were named as the right-wing douchebags of the year. But congratulations on a strong finish.
Thank you. I want to know what the prize is, though.
Well, yeah, the boys down the hall want to know that, too.
Yeah.
So I thought your work, and I said so before you came on yesterday, was among the most important pieces of journalism written in the city this year, if you want to look at the city's finances, because you showed right there that there are people who know themselves they could go and want to go, and yet when it comes to actually making the decision, the senior management won't do it.
Yeah, and there will be more of that before the week is out, John, because as I suspected, people have come out of the woodwork as a result of that column.
Now, I could be wrong. I said you and I agree lots of the time, but not other times. I have said that I thought if you wanted to look for gravy, because I reject the notion that people say there is no gravy, if you want to look for it, you can look for it in the form of what is a bloated middle management and upper management at City Hall, and that if you did a fairly generous buyout package, it would pay for itself many times over in future years.
Absolutely, but, you know, I suspected before, you know, this current regime came in, and long before, that the managers, there are layers upon layers of managers and supervisors, some with very few people to manage, very limited span of responsibility, and there's a lot of turf protection and a lot of empire building, and I think that we will find as the days go on from, you know, the lack of management response. Now, let's not say union response, because the unions are very right here. There were a number of people who put in They wanted to save the organization money. They wanted to leave early. They read the culture. They're close to retirement, or some of them are at retirement and want to head out the door. And it looks, for all intents and purposes, that managers won't let them. Now, the managers have a very, very obvious interest here in protecting their span of control, because some of them have very few people that they manage. But that's where the problem is. That's where the problem is in terms of making decisions about the union people, and it's a problem because there are too many managers.
Now, when Rob Ford obviously wants to find more gravy and sort of quiet down those people who say there isn't any, is it just that they're nervous about having to offer a fair chunk of dough? Because these are often well-paid people, so in order to have them retire early, you'd have to pay them off a bit. And that's severance in our society. That's the way the law works and the way you're going to get people to agree. Is it the queasiness about the money? Is it that they haven't figured this out? I mean, why aren't they doing this?
Well, you know, I don't think the package is so bad. Maybe the upper limit is a little shy, but, I mean, 3 weeks for a union person and 4 weeks for management for every year of service. Now, I would say up to 6 months. I think the intent of the package was to get the people close to retirement out the door and perhaps bridge their time to retirement. So, and the, all the people I've heard from are either at that point. I mean, the gentleman I wrote about the other day was 2 months from retirement. So, you know, and it is an aging workforce. So, I mean, these are things that the city staff had suggested. But my feeling is when push came to shove and the people, they did have a huge buy-in. There were 1,136 people who did buy in. When they faced with the idea of losing the span of control, the numbers, the people to manage, they said, no, we're not going to let go of staff. And I think the other thing is that they're concerned that in the next couple of months there will be some cuts in various programs and they're going to lose staff anyway. The guy I spoke to the other day said to me, it reminded him of the end of the year budget surplus
when everybody rushes around buying stuff they don't even need just so they can not lose the budget. It's what you're saying. These people I was mentioning earlier, in government you're often ranked really in terms of your status, but also even in terms of your pay on how many people you supervise.
Yeah, exactly.
And so if there's fewer of those, then you might think, well, I'll be next or I'll get a pay cut or something bad will happen to me.
Well, you'll see in the next couple of days a few of the people who came out of the woodwork it's absolutely absurd why they were declared essential. I mean, like, I just have to shake my head.
Well, that's part of the problem. Maybe they should be having somebody who's quite removed from the management and from the politics of City Hall dealing with this, and they'd probably get further.
Unfortunately, it goes right up the ranks. And I think that what's happened is the general manager of various departments have convinced the city manager that all these bodies are essential, and it goes right down. I mean, everybody's trying to control their turn.
Yeah. Well, look, we'll look forward. We'll read the pages of the Toronto Sun in the coming days then to keep up with the latest revelations, and I'll keep talking about it because I think if we keep at it, maybe they'll figure it out. But thank you, Sue-Ann Levy, very much, and congratulations again on that fine finish on the right-wing douchebag, if you'll pardon me. That's what they called it.
I'm going out to celebrate today.
Here. Okay. Sue-Ann Levy from the Toronto Sun.
Let's eat cake.
Yeah, that's it. She's on top of all this stuff and will continue to be, as you've heard, in the days ahead.
You can listen to John Tory every weekday afternoon from 4 till 7 on NewsTalk1010.com.
The fact is that we're the ones that have the law on our side. We're the ones that are democratically elected here, and we're enforcing democratically voted bylaws. These people have just squatted in our park and refused to leave.
That was the voice of Deputy Mayor Doug Holliday speaking to you earlier today, the audience, on the Jerry Agar Show. Jerry, of course, basking in the glow of having been named by the protesters at Occupy Toronto as the, well, shared honors with Ryan Doyle, who we'll talk to later, as the right-wing douchebag of the year. Now, there are going to be some very interesting tests in the coming days on this whole issue. Our charter rights will, of course, be tested. The real test coming to court on Friday is how far do our rights of assembly, free speech, and protest go? That is a test of our constitutional rights. Our bylaws and the people and process that pass them will be tested as well. How much protection do those bylaws afford the rights of other people? Not the ones that are protesting, but the other people. People who aren't camping out. That is a test of the effectiveness of our laws and their ability to stand up to legal challenge. The police will be tested. The last time they faced a challenge like this, there were a lot of complaints. And even the police chief has said right on this show that a do-over would perhaps have a different outcome. And I'm talking, of course, about what happened at the time of the G20. The city administration will be tested. Finding that kind of sweet spot between coming down like a sledgehammer on day one of the people being in the park, which I don't think would have been a good idea, or finding the right time, sometime in between then and never, or leaving them there forever. There are legal questions to be sorted out surrounding that choice of, you know, hammer them down the first day, leave them for a while and then tell them to go, or leave them there forever. That's a legal discussion in part, but it's also a political decision of the highest order that will test our politicians as to how that is resolved. Rob Ford ends up wearing it, whatever kind of decision it is. If you see a lot of people injured clearing the park, Rob Ford wears that too. No one has spoken more consistently about the intentions of our lawmakers, and I would argue even the framers of our Constitution, than me in saying it was not their intention, I don't believe it, the lawmakers at City Hall or the framers of our Constitution to set up a regime pursuant to which one group can consistently and continuously assert and exercise their rights at the expense of the rights of a whole bunch of other people, or for that matter, at the expense of the broader public interest. I can't believe the framers of our Constitution intended that anybody that had a beef could go occupy a public park indefinitely, and that was sort of what was considered to be free speech. Because if all 34 million people did that, even the Northwest Territories would be filled up with people occupying their piece of Canada to file their protest. And even if the land, you know, frankly, was meant for other uses. But it is this balancing of rights I've discussed from the beginning which had me not sign on with Jerry Agar, right-wing douchebag of the year. Christy Blatchford, God bless her, she also got a third place finish today as right-wing douchebag of the year, and I'll ask her about that after six. But they both would have moved the protesters out of the park on day one. And I understand their very principled view that the law is the law. And so if you break it on day one, what's the difference? You know, if you and I speed on Monday, it's not like you can say, well, it's Monday today, it's okay. I mean, you're breaking the law, you're breaking the law. So I understand their very principled point of view on that. But I think that, you know, you've got to look at a different concept, a slightly different one, which is that in the course of balancing these rights, which we do every day, the rights of all different kinds of people in different areas, hard as it may be to accept that occupying a park could be construed as a positive exercise of Canadian charter rights. But if you accept that concept, then a couple of weeks in a park, as I put it, puts an exclamation mark on their work, on their protest about whatever it might be. And it isn't, to me, grossly unreasonable. And I think it can lead to what it should lead to. I believe the protesters will and should lose the case on Friday. I believe the protesters will be then confronted by a court-validated order to leave the park, and that will be the most important test of all. Will the protesters, relying on our laws and the process provided to enforce and challenge those laws by going to court, will they then accept what the court says and immediately and without qualification follow the decision of the very same court they sought out to assert their rights? And if the answer is yes, I will have a lot of respect for that. If the answer is no, we will have a much bigger issue than even protest in a park on our hands, namely respect for the rule of law or lack thereof by these people. I continue to believe this, and I give this advice unsolicited and not as even a runner-up candidate for right-wing douchebag of the year by the protesters who obviously listen to the radio station. The best answer of all, their point having been made as best it can be for now, would be for the protesters to leave the park before the court hearing. So they're never put in a position where they're having to be forced out. I think they would enhance the credibility of everything they're doing and saying if they did that. They left and said, okay, we've made our point for now. We're going to find other places and times to do it, but we're out of here because we realize a long-term encampment in a public park can't be the right way to go or the best way to do this. That's what I'd do if I was them. I think they'd get a lot of credit on themselves if they did it before the court hearing, which gives them about 24, 36 hours.
Clayton Ruby is one of Canada's best-known lawyers, and he's someone that's followed and been active in a lot of cases involving people's constitutional rights and criminal defense activities, and he joins us now. Good afternoon, Clay.
Hi.
Thanks for coming on. I've been talking about this, you know, people boil it down to a fight and this kind of thing, but I've been trying to really explain to everybody, including myself, the balancing of rights that's going on here. And I wondered if we could talk a little bit about that and how it will play itself out on Friday. I guess on the one hand, we've got the rights of those who seek to assemble and who seek to protest and who seek to exercise their right to free speech. Let's start with that. What is the sort of present boundary that's been established, recognizing that could change on Friday or any other time, with respect to how far that right goes?
You have to understand that those rights, though guaranteed by the Constitution, are not absolute. They can be limited by government. So the next step is you look to Section 1 of the Charter, which says, okay, when government limits rights, like the bylaw does in this case, the city bylaw, it can do so only if what is passed is a reasonable limit that can be demonstrably justified in a free and democratic society. Well, free and democratic society is one where people do assemble in parks to put pressure on government on political issues. So, you know, you've got to allow the core activity. What might be reasonable limits that the government can justify? Well, they can say, okay, by the end of November, we have to have 3 days to do winterizing the park. And you have to move in two shifts, one first one side, then the other, so we can do that. That would be a reasonable limit in a bylaw, but there's no such bylaw. They can say you can't damage the park. That would be a reasonable bylaw, but there's no such bylaw. So they haven't passed a bylaw that ever took into account the constitutional right to demonstrate, and that's why they're going to have trouble justifying it.
So do you think, just in looking at that balancing of rights, because, of course, they'll be making the argument under some heading or other that the right of other people in the public who are not part of the protest to use the park, or the right of the broader public interest to have a park available for use other than by those who would occupy it, I assume they'll be making some argument in that regard, but you're sort of maybe implying that that won't be one that would necessarily carry the legal day, even if it would carry the public opinion day or the political day.
Yeah, I guess what I'm saying is that if they pass a bylaw saying that, they'd have a decent chance, because the restrictions have got to be, as the Constitution puts it, prescribed by law. That's not what the mayor says should happen or the police chief says. It really means a law. So could they decide, for example, there shall be no more than 500 people in this particular park based on some objective measurement of what the park can hold? Maybe. Have they done that? Nope. So they're going to have a hard time taking what is an arbitrary decision. We've decided you have to go, and turning that into law.
Well, I've said it's going to be a test, and I presume that you'd have a comment on this because you followed so many of these things on the legal and political and constitutional front. It's going to be a test of a whole bunch of players in the system. It'll be a test of the law. It'll be a test of the court system and the charter. It'll be a test of the police in terms of whatever involvement they may or may not have later. It'll be a test of the city government. It'll be a test of the protesters, because if they lose, for example, and are given some sort of an order to leave, will they go along with that? I mean, they could appeal. So I think there's a lot at stake in a decision like this, or in a hearing like this coming up.
I think that's true, but it's really interesting that this is the first time the city's had its bylaws looked at, and they're going to have to say, okay, you know, we just didn't take into account the constitutional right, and the court may just send them back saying, go draft something that can be justified in a democracy, and we'll allow you to put limits on what they can do, but you have to actually allow for the constitutional right to be exercised.
Well, that would put the cat among the political pigeons, I guess, if that were the decision of the court. I don't think people would necessarily expect that. Well, it's been an interesting discussion. I think it'll clarify for people why it's not an open and shut case where it'll just be a 5-minute hearing and they'll say, yeah, out of the park. And we appreciate your helping us with that.
I'm glad to do it.
Clayton Ruby, who is with Ruby, Schiller & Chan, barristers, and he's one of Canada's best-known lawyers, and he's tried to help us through understanding what's going to happen this Friday. You're listening to The Live Drive with John Tory on News Talk 1010.
You can listen to John Tory every weekday afternoon from 4 till 7 on NewsTalk1010.com.
Well, they called us douchebags, and we're not. We're asshats. If I'm as horrible as Christy Blatchford, which they allege, then I've arrived where I want to be.
Christy, I would have said it's not like you to be happy about finishing in the sort of honorable mention category for this esteemed contest conducted by the Occupy Toronto protesters. That is, of course, for the listeners who haven't been listening, honorable mention only, I'll say, as a right-wing douchebag award for distorting the news from the Occupy Toronto protesters.
Well, I feel compelled to point out, though, that I've done this purely on the strength of my radio work, because I have not written in the paper one word about Occupy Toronto. So you can only imagine, I think, that had I written about it, I would easily have grabbed first place.
Well, you know, this raises a number of other questions. Is this you kind of throwing the game, as it were, so that Agar and Doyle could win and be the right-wing douchebag winners of the year, that you sort of didn't deploy all your resources and use all your firepower?
Well, no, though I would be, you know, I'm glad for them that they get the pleasure of finishing first. That wasn't deliberate. It's just that I've been in Kingston and I've been obsessed with something else other than Occupy Toronto. So the only time I talk about it or mention it actually is on the air. I've been asked, this is a good little sidebar, if I may.
Yeah.
There's a very nice young man, a journalism student named Hayden Kenes, who actually I've written a nice letter of recommendation for. He interviewed me a while back, and he's a very bright guy. But apparently he gave the Occupy Toronto people the tip about including me on the right-wing douchebag list, and I gather provided a photograph, and he sent me a note just before I went on air saying, you know, maybe I could give him a shout-out, you know, to thank him. And I wrote back and said, good thing you have that letter of recommendation already.
I was just going to say, I wasn't connecting the dots here. You write this guy a letter, he interviews you, et cetera, et cetera, and then he nominates you for the right-wing douchebag award.
That's my thanks, apparently.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, he'll have a few life lessons to learn in that regard. I mean, you know, but that's okay. You got to learn sometimes the hard way. So how do you feel about the fact, are you surprised that when the government runs anything, they're running this call center, which I think is a splendid idea, where there's one place to call, one simple phone number, 311, but 21% of the calls never get answered, and half the rest of the people wait half their lives to get to talk to somebody?
Yeah, I heard the councillor, one of the new councillors, triple name, Mary Margaret something.
McMahon, yeah.
Yeah, speaking about it and saying, well, you know, it's such a good idea. You know, I think it's a really important service. Well, except that it's not a service if nearly a quarter of the calls aren't being answered and the others are taking too long. Holy smokes. It is a great idea, I suppose, though, you know, there's nothing like getting to the horse's mouth. What people really need is an internal City of Toronto phone book, because then you can phone the guy that you really want, as opposed to phoning 311 so that, you know, 4 months later, when your complaint makes it through the bureaucracy, the right guy gets it.
Rob Ford takes a lot of grief, too. I think you're right about that. I've often said if everybody had the government phone book, they'd be able to figure most things out. But you would certainly see how many people there are working in the government. But to that point, I think Rob Ford, you know, has some things that people criticize him for, but other things on which he's right. And just noted here in the story about this, Calgary has a similar call volume to Toronto and achieves similar results, but uses almost half the staff that Toronto does. So we're not delivering the goods for people, and we're using twice as many people to not do the job as the people in Calgary.
Depressing.
So just to get you really depressed, I predicted I might be able to get you worked up about this, but probably not. You'll be like me. You'll say, look, if they win the Stanley Cup, I couldn't care if Fidel Castro owns them. But the Toronto Maple Leafs, there's now a possibility that some U.S. investment company might buy them. Would you care who owned the Leafs if they were sort of able to put a better team on the ice?
No, I wouldn't, actually. I mean, I used to care back in the days when there were colorful individual owners. You know, I'm thinking of Harold Ballard and the late Johnny F. Bassett with the Toronto Toros. And, you know, those people had wonderful, colorful personalities. Certainly Johnny Bassett was a lovely guy. And the CFL, as you know, still has some of that, you know, small-town ownership groups who really are invested in the community. But for the most part, Major League Sports is like any other big business, and it doesn't really matter who owns it, in my view, as long as, you know, maybe the Americans, given their national penchant for liking to win, would want to have a more successful team.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, I believe a lot of it isn't to do with money or nationality. It's to do with a winning culture and a winning attitude. I mean, I sort of have seen it too much around sports to know that if you sort of get the place infused with this winning culture, it doesn't mean you're going to win, but I think it's a lot harder to do so without it.
I agree. And I mean, you know, if Brian Burke, who is a wonderful guy and a winner, if he can't inspire a winning culture, then, you know, nothing short of wholesale trades will do it. Because I think he's a very charming guy and a very good GM.
Yeah, no, I think so. And look, he's, you know, they're showing signs of life, but I guess I'm not ready to get, you know, the last week has been not so good. I just want you to know, this will be very heartening for you as we conclude another day's conversation, that a caller called in and said that if Christie was officially in the running for the right-wing douchebag award, she would have won the right-wing douchebag Order of Canada. So they're saying, look, if you're going to get in this and deploy all your resources, you're going to go big and get the pin and the medal and the whole thing. So there you go.
Well, that's true.
Yeah, that's better than Mr. Sanchez or whatever his name was. What's his name again?
Hayden Kenes.
Yeah, Mr. Kenes.
He got a shout-out.
Not exactly as he might have intended. Future employers take note. Christy Blatcher, thank you.
Next comes the boot to the head.
Bye-bye. Yeah, exactly. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for listening to the John Tory Podcast. Check out the live drive with John Tory every weekday afternoon from 4 till 7 on NewsTalk1010.com.